Well, what do you recall from last week, looking at Matthew 5 and the first few Beatitudes? Anything?
Oh, you did an awesome job, that's what I remember. There were themes sort of outlining the Beatitudes that I'd never noticed before. They were kind of explained later on.
Okay, good. Very good. Any recollection of what those themes were? Anyone? First three Beatitudes focus on what? Focus on me. Okay, looking internally, sort of doing a self-examination in some ways. The fourth Beatitude. Okay, outside of me toward who? God. It has, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for God and His kind of life, as we'll see. The first three, mostly chapter 5, deals with that. Chapter 6, we see the fourth beatitude expounded upon in terms of God being in the proper place in our life and us hungering and thirsting after Him. And the rest of the beatitudes have to do with my relationships. And we're going to focus on that as well today in the first 12 verses of chapter 7. So, just by way of review as well, the first three Beatitudes were, blessed are those who are poor in spirit, those who are bankrupt in their own spirit, that I realize I have, when we talk about a spiritual equation, I have nothing to offer, is basically what it's saying. And he says, we're blessed when we're in that condition. That's a good place to be. The second one, he says, blessed are those who mourn. Not only do we have nothing to offer to the spiritual equation, we are at the same time going in the wrong direction. And he says, blessed are those who mourn, those who understand or have a sense of how deeply embedded sin is in their life to the point that it brings them to grief. They mourn. Over that, using the same idea that James does in James chapter 4, be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. And he's talking about dealing with the sin in your life, the sin of pride in that particular situation. That's what we ought to do. And then the third thing he says is, blessed are the gentle, or the humble, often translated. And it's the idea of bowing our knees before Him and coming to Him and saying, God, I can't do this. You're the one who is in charge. You're the one who is great and mighty. And I look at myself, I have nothing to offer. I'm going in the wrong direction. I need you. There's that sense of coming before Him, realizing who He is and who I'm not, so to speak. And we looked at chapter 5, verses 20 through 48, a section that begins with, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, your religious leaders, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And then he concludes that section in verse 48 with, therefore you must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And what he's trying to do is to help them realize what we just talked about. They have nothing to bring to the equation because they're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. They mess up on every count. looked at all different facets of life, and we mess up in chapter 5. Sin is deeply embedded in our life, much more so than we typically think. It ought to make us grieve. And it ought to bring us, the rest of chapter 5 ought to bring us to our knees before God. Now, the question becomes, when we look at the fourth beatitude, let's look at that, verse 6 of chapter 5. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Righteousness is a way that I typically think about that is God's kind of life. That's what righteousness is. It's right living, right by whose standard? By God's standard. Righteousness is right kind of living, God's kind of life. And we see in chapter 6, when he expounds on this even more, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, the kingdom which is made up of God and his design and his kind of life. Seek first him and his kind of life, and all these things will be added to you. So that he's talking about something outside of us, because we have nothing to offer, right? We're going in the wrong direction because of sin. We have nothing, so we're seeking for something else. But here's where he talks about not just our condition, but blessed are those who seek something. Those who are hungry and thirsty for something. We want something outside of ourselves. The words hunger and thirst here are not, oh gee, it's almost 6 o'clock, time for dinner, I'm a little hungry. That's not the idea. This is a desperate, these are desperate terms. If I don't have something to eat and drink in the very near future, I'm going to die. I have to have. That's the idea of hungering and thirsting here. It's a desperation. I'm desperate for something, and that something is God and his kind of life. Now, again, we mentioned just briefly, I think, at the end of our time last week, we're never going to get desperate for God and his kind of life as long as we think in our heads, I've got something to offer in this spiritual equation. As long as I think I'm not that bad, I'm pretty good, I've got it together, I'm better than most people, as long as we think we are more than what we really are, we're very likely never going to be drawn to him in desperation. But it's only as I come to grips with who I really am and who I am not that it draws me to him in desperation. God, I need you. So seeking for something outside of myself. Now look at chapter 6, and we'll transition here. He has just concluded with, therefore, you and your own self, if you're going to be good enough for God, have to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. But then he transfers this idea then, I think, of moving toward, well, what do we seek then? If I don't have anything to offer, I'm moving in the wrong direction, I'm on my knees saying, God, I can't do this, where do I go? He says in verse 6, chapter 6, verse 1, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. And then he's going to go in. Verse 2, he says, so when you give to the poor. Verse 9, pray in this way. Verse 16, whenever you fast. So he's going to talk about giving. He's going to talk about praying. He's going to talk about fasting. These are the three great acts of righteousness to the Jewish people. If you wanted to be a really devout Jewish man or woman, you would give to the poor, you would pray, and you would fast. Those are the three great acts of righteousness. And he addresses each one of them. But they are acts of righteousness. Be practicing your righteousness, or acts of righteousness, to be noticed by men. This is probably the best definition, biblical picture of defining hypocrisy that we have in the Bible. Doing things that are religious to be noticed by other people and get a pat on the back or get a that a boy kind of a response from people, or you're really special or you're really good and everything. Doing it with wrong motivations. But he's going to get into, it's more than just doing good things with, don't do good things with wrong motivations. I think the whole thing he gets into by the time we get to the end of the chapter is when you get to the point where you realize when you're spiritually bankrupt, when you're mourning, as he's talked about, when you're humbling yourself, where do I go? And I think he says, basically, in this chapter, first of all, don't go to religious activity, which is what the Jewish people had done historically, is to go to religious activity. Think about it for just a second. I look back at people I've known. I look back at my own time of life growing up and everything. And I think it amazes me that a couple will have their first baby, and they have not been, they haven't darkened the door of a church in forever. But all of a sudden, this little baby comes into their life, and it's like, you know, maybe we ought to start going to church. You know, that maybe that's something we ought to do. Or someone hits a hard spot in life, and they'll think of, maybe I need to go to church, or maybe I need to go to synagogue, or whatever. I think about in more recent history, think about Tiger Woods going through all of the embarrassment of his true life coming to the forefront, which was not a pretty picture by any stretch of the imagination, not socially acceptable. And when he gave his public apology, do you remember what he said? I'm going back to my Buddhist traditions. He's going back to religious activities at this point in time. Now, whether he did or not, or if that was just speech, I don't know. But it's interesting how we tend to think about how, when I don't know what else to do, it's easy to say, I'm going to do something religious. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to go to synagogue. I'm going to follow this. I'm going to do that. We get involved in religious activity, and we start thinking, for us, it's easy to start thinking, well, I'm going to go to church more consistently. I'm going to give. I'm going to pray more. I'm going to read my Bible more. I'm going to do this and this and this. And he's saying, that's not where it's at. Don't settle for a cheap substitute for what those things are designed to really do ultimately, or to be expressions of. So he says here, don't practice your righteousness, don't your supposed right kind of living to get noticed by people. Otherwise, the attention that you get from people is your reward. Then he talks about poor, giving to the poor. Verse 2, would someone read verses 2 through 4? Okay. So what does he tell him not to do?
Not to give in order to be seen and praised for it.
Okay. Okay. Very good. What does he tell him to do?
Do it in secret.
Do it in secret. Okay. Let's add a little color to this. Again, history really often helps us a little bit. He says, when you give to the poor, do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do. Now, we in our culture would think about that being a going through the streets, blowing a trumpet, and that seems sort of weird. Who would really do that? Let me paint a picture for you historically. In the temple at this time, there were coffers in the temple court where people could come and drop coins in, give money. There were 13 of them, and they were numbered, and each one of the numbers was money that would go towards some particular service of the temple. At least the first 12 of them were. The 13th one, as they had arranged it in the temple at that time, as the temple officials had, was something that would be given to the poor. So it was like designated giving. You say, I'm going to give some money to this, I'm going to give some money to this for the temple service and all of that. And then there's one more, it's for the poor. And they happened to put the 13th one in a closed door room where nobody could see you. And it wasn't as handy to get to. Okay? What people would do historically at that time also, by the way, these trumpets were, they were called, these coffers were called trumpets. They were very narrow at the top. They would go down and they would open up big at the bottom. So they looked like a trumpet that had been set down with the big piece down. But it was very narrow. So narrow, nobody could get a hand down in there to get anything out, okay? But plenty of room at the bottom for all these coins to collect. So it looked like a trumpet that had been set down on the thing. He says, that's why they called them trumpets. People would make replica trumpets that would fit around their neck on a chain. They would put their coins that they were going to go to the temple and put in the coffers in those little trumpets on their chest. Now, what happens when you've got a little metal thing on your chest full of coins and you're walking down the street? Jingle, 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 jingle. And it's got the number on it that I'm going to go give to. So I'm announcing to everyone, I'm going to be going and giving to coffer number 3 today, and I've got some coins in there. That's basically what they were doing, was announcing, I'm going to give today. It'd be like us here in our situation where we have boxes at the back of a room, if people want to give, it would be like us, for all practical purposes, saying, hey, everyone, just wanted you to know, I've got a little gift here, and then put it in the box. Okay? That's what he's saying, don't do that. And that's what they were doing. They were announcing, they were sounding trumpets before them as they dangled on their chest, going to the temple area. He says, don't do that. But instead, when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Why? Because you're in this little dark room that you can't see and nobody else can. So that you are giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. This is between you and God. So instead of religious activity, he's saying this is something between you and God, not for other people, not the activity itself, but where are you at in relationship to God? What are you doing in your relationship with Him? Okay. Would someone read verses 5 through 8? Let's look at the next area.
And when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you.
Good.
And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need when you ask Him.
Good. Thank you. I'll cut to the chase a little bit here. There was a famous rabbi during this period of time, during the time of Jesus, known, his name was Rabbi Janai. And Rabbi Janai was famous for being the praying rabbi. He would come out onto the street every morning at the same time, same area, and he would pray this prayer out loud. He would move a pace or two to the right or to the left on the street, on the side of the street, and he would say the same prayer all over again, out loud for everyone to hear. He'd move a couple paces to the right or left, whichever direction he was going. He would just keep moving another pace or two and pray the same prayer. And he would pray that for hours. He would go around the city streets praying those things, the same thing over and over again, and the same thing every day over and over again. So when Jesus says, when you pray, you're not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by men. Someone like Rabbi Janai is a picture of what he's talking about here. Someone who prays out loud in public for the purpose of being noticed. Now, he's not saying never pray out loud in public. Again, the purpose is don't pray out loud in public for the purpose of being heard. Do you ever find when you have the opportunity to pray in public, do you think about talking to God, or are you thinking about how can I make this sound really good so people will be impressed with me, or I won't make a fool of myself, or something like that? How can I do that? I wonder what they're going to think about me. I want to be careful about this. What should I say? When we start going through all that stuff in our heads, it's not what God wants. God wants us to talk to Him. The issue here is not so much the public nature of it. It's the, why are we doing it? Are we doing it? Is this something we're doing with God, or is this something we're doing for the benefit of other people to hear me talk to God? But he says, this is something between you and God, and we need to understand that. Then he gives us the what's known as the Lord's Prayer there. Pray then in this way, Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors, and do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Notice that it starts off with, who is the focus of this prayer? God. At the very beginning of it, when you look at verses 9 and 10, the first half of this prayer is focused on Him. Our Father, who is in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. God, I want you and your kingdom. That's what's important to me. And you as the one who is in charge in the first two verses, verses 9 and 10, you are the one, I'm trusting you to take care of me. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts. I'm asking you to be involved in my life. Take care of me. You're the one in charge. And we'll come back and look at some more of that a little later on at the end of the chapter. Look at verse 16. Would someone read verses 16 through 18? Let's look at the third area of righteousness to them.
Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you.
Yeah. So again, we don't need to spend a lot of time on that, but it's pretty obvious when you make sure that you look really down and out and everything else, and someone says, so that people will say, what's wrong with you today? Oh, I'm fasting today. I have to be careful of things, doing stuff like that. I don't know about you, but if I'm honest, it's easy to fall into those traps and let people know how sacrificial I am and how, or whatever the case may be. But he's saying, don't do that. Don't fall in that trap. He says in verse 18, as was read, and your father, so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your father. This is something between you and him.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was just wondering, what is the purpose of fasting? It says how to do it, but what should be the proper motives for fasting?
Fasting is being willing to give up. It's like, why do we give? God doesn't need money. We give because we're saying, God, I'm willing to give up something for you and trust you to take care of what the shortfall that this is creating. Okay? In the same way with our food, it's a way of devoting, it's a way of focusing our focusing on Him and our time with Him that we talk about. As I recall, I may be wrong on this. Jared, you may be able to help me. I think in the Old Testament, there was only one, as I recall, only one time a year they were commanded to fast, as I recall. I may be wrong. It may be a little bit more than that. But for some of them, this was something they were doing a lot because it got a lot of attention. When you did, I'm super spiritual. Do you remember? Yeah, I.
Nothing stands out.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that they weren't required to fast by the law, very much at all. There was some where they were supposed to do that, but not every week, kind of a thing by any stretch of the imagination. Do you have anything to add, Jared, by the way, on fasting, purpose of it?
Yeah, I think it's not normal for us, so it's, the other thing for fasting is there's a part of it that's really easy to hide, to do or not to do. So, like, I think there's can be this assumption about fasting that most of us are like, I like to eat, I don't like feeling that way. Fasting from other things, just a denial of thinking. I think it's also, there's a danger in it of being like the super spiritual answer way to a demanding thing in life versus like, what if it was a normal practice? You know, Shane and I had a good conversation about that for our church yesterday. Just like, what would a practice of that in our staff look like? Versus a few weeks ago, our life group, one of the little kids with a couple had a surgery. So, some people decided to do that during a surgery or something like that. So, I think it's a discipline. So, where it works itself out in the anatomy is at the core. You know, it's that part of you that's submitted in the mind that wants to seek God and stuff like that. So, discipline your body for the sake of either gaining insight or being patient or something like that.
Yeah.
I think it's a lost art.
Verses 19 through 24. Could someone read those? Good. So as we go through 19 through 24, he mentions a few different things, but there's a common theme in all of this. In verse 19, don't store up treasure this way, but in verse 20, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Verse 22 and 23, he talks about the lamp. The eye is the lamp into the body and all of that that gives light. But if your verse 23, your eye is bad, the whole body will be full of darkness. And it leads to verse 24, I think, and what he's dealing with here. I'm having to sort of skip through because we got quite a bit to cover. But verse 24, no one can serve two masters. We're serving one master or another. Now, as we've looked at this chapter this far, who are the two masters so far in this chapter, in verses 1 through 18? Who are the two masters that we have a choice to serve? Ourselves is one, right? And who's the other? Who should we be doing these things for, so to speak? God. So far, what he's looked at in verses 1 through 18, he's looked at two masters. One has been me. The other has been God. I can't serve both. Who am I going to serve? The real operative word here is, who am I going to serve? Who's going to be the master? Who's going to be in charge? And through verse 18, it's me or God. Am I doing what I'm doing for me, serving my interests, my selfish, self-centered interests? Or am I doing what I'm doing for God and for His benefit, for who He is, based upon who He is? When it comes to my treasure, is my treasure something that's for me or is it for God? And then he comes down in verse 24, no one could serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other, one or the other. We can't have it both ways. You cannot serve God and, what do your different translations say? Wealth, money. Probably the best way to translate that in our culture today is maybe, I don't know. You cannot serve God and other things, stuff. Can't do it. And in the context, I think it's stuff that I'm collecting or whatever for me, for my benefit, for my enjoyment. Now, okay, so just one.
Pharisees added a couple during the silent years, the 400 years, that were weekly religious acts.
Yeah.
Old Testament just did it.
Yeah. So one was required, but some people were super spiritual because we were doing this every week or whatever. And making sure everybody knew what I was going through it because of the way I look. So verse 24 is really, in many ways, he's taken us up this hill, and we're at this precipice now, and he says, let me tell you what it comes down to. We've got to choose. Who am I going to live for? Who am I going to live for? Am I going to live for me? Am I going to live for things and the things they can produce for me? Am I going to live for me, or am I going to live for God? Am I going to be in charge, or is He going to be in charge? But he goes on, part of what he says here, though, is you will either hate the one and then you'll love the other. If I'm living for myself, he says, basically, I'm going to eventually hate God. If I'm devoted to myself, I'm going to despise God. That's what's going to happen in my life. Sometimes we talk about, I don't feel close to God. God feels distant to me. I feel like my prayers are hitting a, a glass ceiling and just bouncing right back. We'll say all these different things. I feel spiritually dry. And not always, but often, the problem has nothing to do with God. The problem has, it's not that God went away or God isn't listening to my prayers or God doesn't care about me or God's not involved in my life. Often, when we feel that way and we go through that kind of stuff, it's because of the choice we've made to live for self, to live for me. And when I do that, I'm going to find myself distancing myself from God. Because he is a constant reminder that I'm going in the wrong direction, that I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing. The more it's almost impossible to read my Bible on a consistent basis and stay caught up with me of how great I am. Because the Bible is constantly reminding me as a human man, as a human being, what a mess I am and how great he is. Any thoughts about this at all? You guys are so quiet. Yeah, I think when we fast, it ought to be for the purpose of spending more time with him, focusing on him, that sort of thing. I think we need to avoid what Jesus is warning against here, and that is fasting for religious sake. Okay? So I'm going to be more spiritual, or I'm going to grow spiritually by not eating today. I don't think so. I think you may grow hungry, but you're not going to grow more spiritual just by not eating. The question is, what are you doing instead of eating? Are you spending that time focused on him and that sort of thing? Okay, verses 25 through 34. Could somebody read those?
Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, but your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you by being anxious can add a single hour to his life, to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow, they neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble.
So what's he saying there? He starts off with verse 25, therefore, or for this reason. He's pointing back to what we've looked at. So what is he saying in verses 25 to 34? What are some of the key elements there? Any other thoughts? Good. That's very good.
Along with that, following verse 24, what you said about the stuff and the clothing, don't worry about the stuff. Don't worry about
Yeah, and he's focused specifically on two of the three primary elements needed for life, food and clothing. Food, clothing, and shelter are the things we typically say every human being needs. He's talking about food and clothing. You know, is that where our focus is at? These things that I, again, that when I talked about things or stuff, that you can't serve God and those things. I think that's part of what he's getting at here is some of the stuff of life that we focus on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back in the day, like, I guess context-wise, was this like an important issue with clothes and stuff? Or like, I find it kind of weird that, I mean, they weren't like worrying about like style or anything, were they? Or was it just like basic needs? I never really thought about it until right now.
Yeah, I'm not aware, I should say. That's all I can really say. I'm not aware of fashion being a big issue in the Jewish community. In Rome, it would have been, in the Roman community, but not as much that I know of in the Jewish community. However, I think what he's doing here is talking about even the basic necessities of life. I mean, we all have to wear something, and we all have to eat something to function in this world. And he says, but is that where your focus is at? Is that where your attention is at? Is that what's most important to you? Is providing the basic necessities of life? I guess one thing, the way to look at it is that what I'm, are we worried about taking care of the things that we need in this life? Is that what our focus and attention is on? Now, I don't think he's saying those things are not important and you shouldn't eat or put any clothes on. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think what he's getting at down at the bottom in verse 33, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and trust him that you're going to be able to have these things. Now, he may provide those things by giving you a good job, by a lot of other things, but is that what we're focused on? Is that what life is to us, is just surviving, just putting on clothes, eating food, going through the motions of living life? Is that what life's all about for us? It's an empty, vain life if that's what it's all about. But he says, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Make that the priority of your life. And it's amazing how all the other things we tend to worry about and think about all the time will be taken care of. They'll fall into place. Let me, this is sort of a pet peeve of mine. I grew up, even through grad school, being told there are certain priorities in life. There's God, and if you're married, there's your spouse, and if you have children, it's your children, and then it's your church and your work, and I would be given this priority list of life, God, and everything. God was always at the top, but then there was a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on down through the scale. Then I had somebody tell me, you can tell what's really important to you, what your true priorities are, by looking at two things, your calendar and your checkbook. And I bought into that for a while, and then something dawned on me. If I'm really honest, if I look at my calendar, sleep is the most important, is the priority of my life. It's the single most thing I do consistently every day for 8 hours a day at that time. I wish I could do that now, but I'm getting old, can't do that anymore. But I look at it, it's either sleep or work, one of the two, because I can't say it's God, because I don't spend 8 to 10 hours a day praying and reading my Bible. I mean, so if I'm looking at it real pragmatically that way, I'm looking, and if I look at my checkbook, I'd have to say my house is the most important thing, because that's the single biggest payment I make every month is my house payment. You know, and I'm thinking, is that really how you determine your priorities? And then I got to thinking about priorities, values, what's important, how do you determine those things? And I started studying this passage. And when he says, seek first his kingdom, he's not saying first among many other priorities. I'm convinced he's not. He is saying here, that is the priority. It's the priority, not a priority that's at the top of a list. It's the priority of our life. And when it is the focus of our life, the priority of our life, it's amazing how all the other issues and all the other things of life will fall into their proper place. So, in my situation, I'm married. And I am told in Ephesians chapter 5 that I am to love my wife like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. What did he give up for her? He gave his life. He died for her. That sounds like she's the most important thing in my life if I'm following Ephesians chapter 5, right? I mean, if you give your life for something, isn't that pretty much at the top of the list, seems like. And I got to think, well, how can that be? But I'm doing what he wants me to do. In making my wife the most important person in my life, I am making him the most important person in my life because I'm doing what he told me to do. Does that make any sense at all? Is that confusing? All the other activities of life, all the other things I do in life will fall into place as long as I'm keeping my eyes on him and who he is and what he wants, what he is all about, his kingdom. Seek first his kingdom. The most important, can you have a kingdom without a king? Isn't the king what defines a kingdom? Seek first him and his kingdom, his righteousness, his kind of life. And all the other things in life will fall into place where they ought to be. All my other priorities, all the other activities, all the other things. So do I own a home or do I rent a home? Or an apartment or whatever I do. Well, as long as I'm keeping my focus on him, seeking him and his righteousness, that decision is going to be an easier and easier decision to make all the time. What do I do about that? Do I buy this or do I not buy this? Do I go here or do I not go there? All of those things will fall into place as long as he is the focus of my life. I'm seeking him and his righteousness, his kind of life, the life he designed for me. As long as I'm focusing on that, it's amazing how all the other things we call other priorities will fall into their proper place. So I work more than I do anything else, any other single thing in life, I work. And you say, well, you're a pastor, so you're doing spiritual things and everything. The way I'm wired, if I was a mechanic, the single most thing I would do in life would be to work, just the way I'm wired. My son, Eric, went through seminary. He helped plant a church in Denver for 3 years and then moved to Southern California and is working in commercial construction now. And It's interesting because we'll have these conversations and he'll say, Dad, I have more opportunity for ministry in many ways now as vice president of this company than I ever had as a pastor. As a pastor, I got paid to do that and everybody sort of expected me to do those things. But as VP of a construction company, he said, I have a voice into people's lives and what I say has a lot of weight and everything. And he said, Dad, I work in construction all day long, but I'm in ministry 24 hours a day. If we're seeking Him and His kingdom, whatever we do, it's going to fall into place. It's the priorities, the values we call them, are going to fall into place. So in verse 34, don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. We are, by nature, I think our human nature is to worry about things, is to have concern over the unknown. What is tomorrow going to bring? What's it going to be like? Am I going to get this thing that I'm applying for? Am I going to get the job? Am I going to get the loan? Am I going to whatever? All kinds of things that we don't know what tomorrow brings. And it's easy for us to look at tomorrow and say, and to start worrying, to start saying, how am I going to handle this? What am I going to do? How am I going to get this done? Whatever it may be. And he says, if he's in the proper place in our life, if he is the priority of my life, not a priority, the priority of my life, everything else is going to fall into place. I've beat that horse to death, but it's so important for us to realize that. Where do we turn when we realize I'm bankrupt in my own spirit? I realize sin is deeply embedded in my life, and it brings me to the point of grieving, mourning. When I fall on my knees before God and say, God, I have nothing to offer. God, you are the one who is great and mighty, and I'm not. I realize that. Where do you turn? You don't turn to religious activity. You don't turn to religion. You turn to Him and make sure He is the priority of your life. Okay, and everything else will fall into its proper place. Now then, let's go back to chapter 5 and look at a few more Beatitudes. He says in verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. You're going to see the words mercy and grace throughout the New Testament. If I could give you a distinctive difference between the two, it might be helpful to you as you read through your New Testament. And I'm going to give you just sort of a nutshell, a simple idea of what the difference is between mercy and grace. They are both expressions of God's love. They are both expressions of His compassion. But mercy is God's compassion or love expressed toward those who are hopeless. God's grace is His love or compassion expressed to those who are guilty. Okay, if I can just truncate them in terms of a real basic distinction between the two. Mercy has to do with compassion toward helplessness, and toward the helpless. Grace has to do with compassion toward the guilty. So here he's saying about us, blessed are we when we are compassionate toward those who are helpless. James, remember James, the good friend of Matthew, wrote, this is pure and undefiled religion that we take care of widows and orphans in their distress. Now, what do widows and orphans have in common when you think about that culture? Helpless. That same kind of thing. Blessed are the merciful. Then the second one, the verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart. Another way of saying this, translating this Greek, is blessed are those who are unmixed in their heart. Unmixed. We don't say one thing and do another thing. We don't have mixed motives in the way we work with other people or relate to other people. I have a pure heart. The Native Americans had a expression about the white man when he came into the country and moved toward into the West. He said, "You speak with a forked tongue. You say one thing, but you really mean something else." How did that affect Native Americans? What did they think about that? Not too highly. We don't like it when people say one thing but do another, or say one thing but mean something else. And he's saying we need to be not forked tongue but single tongue, single heart, one thing in our relationships with other people. And then he says in verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers. Peacemakers are those who seek to bring peace in people's situations. So in my relationships with other people, I seek peace. Paul says in Romans chapter 12, the end of that chapter, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Pursue peace in my relationships with other people. But also a peacemaker is someone who works to bring peace between other people. Not just me and them, but between them as well and others. I'm out there doing that. But the way I do that in the New Testament, the way we see a peacemaker described in the New Testament is one who brings the peace of God to other people. So I'm one who brings God's peace, the peace of God, to other people. Part of that is the gospel, bringing the gospel of peace to other people. When you study Romans next semester with Shay, in chapter 1, you're going to see that in the chapters 1, 2, and 3, the wrath of God is displayed against all mankind because of the choices that we have made in life. There is a war that has been declared between God and mankind because of mankind's choices and activities. But when we get to chapter 5 of Romans, you're going to see that chapter 3, verse 21, you're going to see a peace treaty has been signed. The gospel in many ways is what God has provided to bring peace to this war that we created by our sin. So think about it that way. We're bringing God's peace to other people. We're bringing God's peace in our relationships to other people that we have, and helping bring peace to them as well. But it's all focused, all of these, merciful, pure in heart in terms of how I relate with other people, peacemakers, what I'm bringing to other people and to the situation, all have to do with my relationship with other people. First three Beatitudes have to do with me internally. Fourth Beatitude has to do with me and God. The rest of the Beatitudes have to do with me and other people, how I relate to them. And again, from an anatomy point of view, we talk about working from the core, from the inside, and our relationship with God, and it moves out, and that sort of thing, into our relationships with other people eventually. In verse 10, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, etc. So he's saying even in negative situations, it's going to affect the way we live there when we are being put down, persecuted, and all of that. Now then, so all of that has to do, all of those last Beatitudes have to do with me and other people. Look at chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 1, do not judge lest you, so that you will not be judged. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. Do not judge, or there's going to be a negative thing that happens in your life, and that is you're going to be judged. Okay? If you want to avoid being judged by the people, don't judge. Uh-huh. Yes. I think what we're going to see here is they're going to do that. Now, there will be judgment from God too, but I think in terms of how I relate with other people, if I'm a judgmental person, I'm going to talk about what the word judge means here in a second, but if I'm doing that, I'm going to tend to have that done to me too. And I think he spells that out as we go through. Great question. Great segue. Thank you. The word judge. There are different words that are used for judge in the New Testament. This particular word, krino, in the Greek, is a word that has a compilative kind of meaning. So let me tell you the different meanings, and then I'll tell you what this word means. There's one word for judge that means to gather evidence. Think about a trial. One thing that happens in a trial is there's the gathering of evidence. That's one of the words used for judge in the New Testament. Another word is for judge is to weigh the evidence. Think about that in a courtroom where a jury is having to weigh the evidence that is being presented back and forth to them. And the third word for judge that is often used in the New Testament has to do with coming up with a verdict. So you have, in a courtroom situation, you have lawyers who are presenting evidence. The jury is hearing the presentation of all that evidence. Then they're weighing the evidence. Does it lean in one way or another? And then they're coming to a verdict. Those are the three words, primary words, that are used for judge in the New Testament. However, at this point in time, this particular word had developed to mean all of those things with a little twist. It had meant to gather evidence and weigh the evidence for the purpose of, and this is the twist, for the purpose of coming up with a guilty verdict. We would call it, I don't know if it's an expression we use much today, but there's an expression called a kangaroo court. It's where a courtroom setting is set up, but the whole purpose of it, the verdict has already been decided ahead of time. We're just going through the motions so that we can get to that verdict. So all the evidence that's gathered and presented is for the purpose of making sure that we get the verdict we've already decided on before the evidence. Make sense? That's what this word has come to mean when we look at it here. Do not gather evidence, weigh the evidence for the purpose of coming up with a guilty verdict of other people, or they're going to do the same thing to you. Sort of come alive a little bit. We do that sometimes in our relationships. I'm not trying to be condemning of you. We all, I think all humanity at times, there are people we just don't like. And we look for ways to justify not liking them. That's called gathering evidence. And we look at that evidence through a slanted eye because we don't like them. We see the evidence a certain way, and then we justify why we don't like them. And that's our verdict, because something's wrong with them. And if we do that with other people, they're going to tend to turn around and do that with us. Now, notice what he goes on. It says in verse 2, because he specifically answers your question here. For in the way you judged, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. In verse 3, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Why do you look at that little, why don't you notice the, well, he says, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, that little little bitty thing, when there's this great big thing in your own eye? It's sort of ironic kind of illustration here of, can you see someone who's really good at cartoon figures and stuff, somebody have a log in their eye. You know, it's sort of hard to miss, you know. Not only if someone looking at me, but it's hard for me to see anything if this log's in my eye. He says, you've got a log in your eye, but all you can see is the speck of dust in this other person's eye. He says, you need to look at yourself. Look at your own self first. Verse 4, or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? Can't help somebody else as long as you're not dealing with your own stuff. Verse 5, you hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. What has that got to do with anything? So he says, first of all, look at your own stuff. Look at your own stuff. Look at yourself first. You need to have an honest appraisal. Paul says in Romans chapter 12, do not think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. Okay? But think soberly as to have sound judgment. Look at yourself realistically. Be honest about who you really are. We need to do that, Paul says. I think that's what Jesus is saying here. Before I can be meaningfully involved in other people's lives in a helpful way, a healthy way, I've got to deal with my stuff. I've got to look at myself, be honest about who I am, deal with my own stuff. Then I'm freer to be able to relate to other people in a healthy way. Okay? And then he says in verse 6, do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine. He's giving a warning here. Not everybody is going to appreciate what you have to offer relationally. Let me put this in a more modern day context. Can you imagine someone, I'm sure it happens, and I'm sure in their circumstances they wouldn't think a thing about it, but I think about it from mine. I cannot imagine when one of my kids was 2 years old going out and buying them a Rolex watch for $10,000. I just can't even imagine giving a two-year-old a $10,000 watch. First of all, they can't read it. It makes no sense to them. Secondly, they have no sense of the value of it, and so they're going to tend to waste it, abuse it, not take care of it, because they don't understand the value. They're not capable of understanding the value of it. Do not give what is holy to dogs. Don't give things to people who are not capable of appreciating them. Do not throw your pearls before swine. Same thing. Don't give what is really valuable to someone who is not capable of appreciating it. Now we can look, he's not calling other people dogs and swine. In the illustration here, he's saying, don't give that which is special, valuable to you, to anyone who's not capable of appreciating it, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. Be careful about thinking that if I give somebody time, money, possessions, we could go on and on the list of giving people something else, giving them even truth, that at this point in their life, they're not even capable of understanding the value of it. Be careful of that, or they're going to turn around and throw it back in your face, so to speak. So in our relationships with other people, we need to be careful about all of that. I've seen a lot of frowns. Questions, thoughts?
I may have missed it, but how does that connect to the first five verses? How does that flow?
It doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah. The first five verses, I think, are a principle of relating to other people. Deal with your own stuff first. Second principle I think he's talking about here in verse 6 alone is don't give to other people verbally or tangibly things that they are not capable of appreciating. It will be a waste. And it may even be harmful coming back at you. And then in verse 7, I think he, through 11, I think he has a third principle that we need to understand.
Mm-hmm. We're back to verse 6. Uh-huh. I feel like it's saying you shouldn't tell other people like the gospel because they might not appreciate it.
No, it's not if they might not appreciate it. If it's only if they're not in a position where they can even possibly appreciate. So let me... there's one thing about again, if we're sharing the gospel in terms of sharing four laws with people, spiritual laws or something like that, that's we're talking about one thing. If I'm talking about sharing my story and that Jesus has had an impact in my life, he's changed my life, I realized he forgave my sins. He's offering me a new life, and I accepted that by faith, and it's changed my life. I'm telling my story. That's one thing. But if I'm going in and I'm hammering someone who's not interested, not wanting to know, and they make that clear to you, or they're in a position where they just can't at this moment appreciate it, I'm not going to go in and use the gospel like a sledgehammer and hit them over the head. You're going to appreciate this one way or the other. You need this, that kind of a thing. But if I'm just sharing my story, I'm throwing it out there for them to hear or respond if they want to. That's another thing. But I think what he's talking about here is don't give what, just the basic principle of life, don't give to other people either an opinion or things that they are virtually incapable of appreciating the value of. Okay?
Mm-hmm. That word pearls kind of reminds me of like some of the proverbs that talk about like instruction, that someone will hate you if you like a fool if you try and give instruction, something like that, or it'll scorn you.
Mm-hmm. I think it's similar. Yeah. Yeah. Good thought. How are we doing on time here? I gotta
15.
Okay. Verses 7 through 11. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. And everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, when his son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he will give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? So he's talking about here, ask and it will be given. Seek and you'll find. Knock and the door will be open. He's talking here about this. Do you ever have big questions in life about how do I do this, or how can I make this happen, or whatever? How should I share my faith with this person or not? All of that. Ask. Seek. Knock. He says, ask me. Ask for help and everything. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. By the way, I use this passage when... this is a passage about life. This is not... there were no Christians at this point when Jesus is saying this, okay? The word Christian hadn't even been invented yet. Not until long after Jesus was gone in Antioch, they first called people Christians there, Christ followers. The church had not been established yet. I think he's giving a basic principle of life here. If we as human beings will ask him, it will be given. If we seek, we'll find. If we knock, it will be opened. If we pursue God and ask for his help in living life on this earth with other people and all that, he's going to respond to that. When people ask me, what about if Jesus is the only way, what about people who are in other parts of the world who've never heard about Jesus? Well, two things, though. First of all, they have heard about God in his creation, and they know about God in their heart. Romans chapter 1, when you get there again, God has revealed himself in the heavens, in his creation, and God has revealed himself within the heart of every man in Romans chapter 1. Because of that, they can pursue, they can ask, they can seek. God, there must be a God there. If you're there, will you respond? Will you help me understand you more? God will hear and respond to those kinds of prayers. If they will ask, seek, find, based upon what they already know in his creation and in their heart, he will respond as well and provide that. So it's a comparative thing here in verse 11. Just God is so much more anxious to respond to us if we will ask him. But he hasn't moved totally away from the relational thing. I think he's saying here, think about how relational God is in verse 11, but verse 12, in everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets. How do we treat other people? That's the capstone of this section, is treat other people the way you want to be treated. You want to have friends? Be a friend. Judy and I, when we first got married, in the dark ages, we after about a year of marriage, 9, 10, 12 months of marriage, we realized before we got married, all of our friends were single, and those friendships were waning to say the least, because we were sort of lepers to our single friends now because we were married. And it was like we were out of touch and we didn't have, you know, whatever. It was sort of weird. But we didn't have any couple friends. We didn't know that many people who were married that were already friends. So we just, and we had moved to go to school. So we didn't have any couple friends. And we need to have, why don't we have more couple friends? And I happened to be reading this passage and it just dawned on me, I wonder how good of friends we've been to other couples. And we hadn't been. We'd been all, our first year of marriage, we were all caught up in us. And there's a certain part of that that's valuable and everything, but we were saying we need something else. And so we started inviting friends over, or people that we had met over. They were in the same school. We were around them, but we never had built friendships. We just started saying at least once a month we're going to have another couple over. We got to know four couples really well, and we started inviting, as the four couples of us, once a month another couple to come, and we just wanted to get to know them better. And it was amazing how many friends, couple friends, we developed in those 4 years of grad school, and in the last 3 years. but friends that we still have today. But we got them because we were friends, not because it just happened. You could apply that to all different kinds of things. Are people critical of you all? Are lots of people critical of you all the time? Need to ask the question, am I being critical of other people all the time? Etc. There's a twist in verse 12 that we should not miss. And that is this, based upon what we looked at earlier, he says, in everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want to be, want them to treat you. And the twist, the inferred thing there from what we saw in the first verses, the first first six verses is, because that's the way they are going to treat you. Treat other people the way you want to be treated, because that, generally speaking, is the way they're going to treat you. You want people to be gracious to you and thoughtful of you. Be gracious and thoughtful of other people. You want other people to be compassionate toward you. Be compassionate toward them. We tend to reap what we sow in our relationships with other people and everything. Now, the rest of the chapter, he is challenging them. He says, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. It's like all of a sudden, he gets to verse 12, he gives this capstone about relationships, and then he moves into this, enter through. You need to make a choice. He's calling his disciples, in the hearing of all these people, to make a choice. Your life is going to lead somewhere. He says, he's challenging them, enter through the narrow gate and that sort of thing, and not the wide gate. Well, what is that all about? His audience is, what is that all about? He goes on in verses 15 and following, and verse 15 through 19, and tells them not everyone is what they appear to be. And then in verse 21, he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Think about this. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Do you think that would cause a bit of consternation? Do you think they might be a little, whoa, do you think there's a little bit of a shockwave that goes through the crowd at this point as he's saying all that? Verse 24, I think, is masterful on Jesus' part. All of it is, but this is so cool. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against the house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand in the Wadi. You're going to hear about that when you get to Israel. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and slammed against the house, and it fell, and great was the fall. What he has just said, if you will hear these words of mine and act upon them, what words of mine? The sermon I just gave you, the message everyone who hears these words of mine, truly hears them and acts upon them, things are going to be good. If not, things are going to be bad. Do you think, the masterful part about this is, I remember the first time I read that and really wrestled with that, really caught what that was saying. It was like, well, maybe I ought to go back and look at this message again. You know? It might be good to go back and hear those words one more time. and everything. Notice the audience response, verse 28. When Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching. Doesn't say anything about the disciples, but the crowds were amazed by his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority, not as their scribes. And they are astonished at what he's saying. When they say amazed, they're not saying, boy, you are the greatest teacher ever, although that was maybe part of it. I think they're amazed because these are things they have never heard before. These are powerful things, things that make sense, but are so out of the ordinary. This caught them off guard. They were not expecting to hear this. I don't think any of these Jewish people had ever heard the way to the first step you need to take in getting to heaven is to be bankrupt in your spirit. I don't think any of them had ever thought, that's the first step. No. The first step to them was always understand the law, practice the law, do the law. That was it. Understand it, do it. That's it. And Jesus knocks that out from underneath them in chapter 5. Okay, that's your standard. Let's follow it all the way through. Be perfect as God is perfect. Okay, that's it. You got it. Okay, it's all yours. You know, it had to be amazing to them, surprising to them, to say the least. Okay? We spent an inordinate amount of time on three chapters, Jared, out of your time in the gospel. So thank you for giving me the privilege of doing this. Okay, I've got 1 minute. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much. Thank you for Jesus being willing to come. Thank you for this teaching that we can listen to and hear the words even today, 2,000 years later. We can hear the voice of our Master speaking truth to us, speaking life to us, helping us understand You and your kingdom, helping us understand who we are, who we're not, helping us understand more and more the life that you've called us to. God, I pray that you would continue to help us understand clearly, each one of us, who we are, who we're not, who you are, and who we are before you. Help us understand how to make you the priority of our life. And as we do that, see how it begins to change us and change the world around us. In Jesus' name, amen.